I don't know.
Is this thing on? It is.
Hello.
Are you ready? We're starting.
Yeah, okay. We're starting. Go yeah, we're it. Starting.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lauren from Paradise After Dark.
Dark.
Podcast.
That's their thing.
That is our thing. Yeah. Dark.
Where are you from, Lauren?
I am from Florida, born and raised Floridian. Our podcast covers mostly Florida cases, but we've just recently branched out. Now we're covering any case, anywhere.
All right.
So give us a listen, Paradise After Dark. And, yeah. And what's your name?
My name is Kelly Behrens Brink from the True Crime IRL podcast. I am from Iowa. I cover a lot of Midwest cases, a lot of Iowa cases that nobody's ever heard of before. And speaking of Iowa, well, is anyone from Iowa? Hello. That's my family, by the way. So, so Iowa case is something we're going to cover today. It's one you've probably never heard of. It's the Villisca Axe Murder case.
Has anyone heard that?
You know of this? You know the case. Okay. How do you know? Okay. So recently, Morbid did an episode on that, which was really good. A few people have covered it. We're going to cover it in a different way because Lauren and I took a field trip last October and we rented the Villisca Axe Murder House and we slept in it. Except, where did you sleep, Lauren?
I slept in the car.
She slept in my Jeep. She was scared. So anyway, but my 82-year-old mother even came. We had a whole paranormal team with us. It was a blast. And my 82-year-old mom slept on the floor in a sleeping bag just fine. But Lauren slept in the Jeep, which is fine. I'm not judging. You're totally okay.
Yeah. Don't judge me. Just tell everyone in this room about it. Okay.
So we're going to talk about the true crime aspect, but we're going to mix it up with the paranormal stuff because I think that's fun. I'm into all the ghosts and stuff. So we're going to talk about both parts of that. So take it away, Lauren, with the history.
Dive into it. Okay. So long before serial killers and mass murderers were like a way of life, two adults and six children were bludgeoned to death in the tiny town of Villisca, Iowa. Now, Villisca, in the early 1900s, it's a Midwestern town of about 2,500 people, and it was flourishing. It was a flourishing little town. They had businesses lining the streets, and dozens of trains were stopping and coming and going, dropping things off and picking things up.
It was way more populated, actually, in those days than
it is
now,
right now, so. Actually, yeah. So the Moore family consisted of the patriarch, Josiah Moore. He was 43. And his wife, Sarah, she was 37. They had four children, 11-year-old Herman, 10-year-old Mary Catherine, 7-year-old Arthur Boyd, and 5-year-old Paul Vernon. They were considered actually an affluent family in this town, and they were very well-liked. Everyone knew the Moores. Everybody liked the Moore family.
Yes. So they were like the perfect little family.
They were. So on the Sunday evening, June 9th of 1912, the Moore family, along with two neighborhood girls, Lena and Ina Stillinger, they were 9 and 11, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah, Ina was 9 and Lena was 11.
Yep.
And they all went to the Children's Day service at the Presbyterian Church.
And Sarah Moore was leading that because she was like in charge of the children's church at their congregation.
Exactly. And all of the Moore children and the Stillinger girls were participating in this service. So it was kind of a big deal. It was like a once a year thing, and it was kind of a big deal. The kids were really excited about it.
And the whole town got together for these little things like this. And
Lena and Ina had asked permission to have a sleepover at the Moore's house that night. So the event ended around 9:30 after some social mingling, and the family walked the three blocks back to their house along with the Stillinger girls. And it's the crazy part is that the town was super dark that night.
Dark.
I love it. The town and the electric company were actually having some sort of dispute. So the electric company turned off all the electricity in the entire town, making it completely black.
Yes.
And this is not, I mean, this is a true story. It sounds like a lead-in to some sort of horror movie, but it is a true horror movie.
Yeah.
The story is actually pretty horrific.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, a very petty argument over, like, rates or something.
Yes.
So the power company just turned it all off. You're done. No lights for you. So that's how the night began. A very dark, dark night in Villisca. So when I think of the 1900s and kids and families back then, it's funny because, like, I never really thought of people back then having sleepovers. So I just imagine all these little kids in their little old-timey outfits just playing with an abacus and, like, a stick or something, and that was maybe some marbles. I don't know. But that's what they did maybe for sleepovers. There were no video games. So, but, yeah, I can totally imagine them on their dark walk home, you know, maybe skipping and singing some church songs as they headed home. Just like they were super happy. They were excited. They were having a sleepover. And it's really sad that they did not know what was to come in just a couple hours.
Right. Once they got home, the children had some cookies and milk, which I think is a very early 1900s
so
thing.
Wholesome. Yes. Just like
it is,
Santa.
It is.
Like
Santa,
cookies and milk,
right here,
too.
Is our friend.
Jason Usry from Santa May Be a Criminal. Sorry, I digress.
So after their milk and cookies, everyone went to bed. The Stillinger girls slept in the bedroom downstairs. All the more children slept upstairs in the small bedroom that they all shared. And then Josiah and Sarah slept in the tiny bedroom that's right at the top of the stairs.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to set this up so you can imagine there's a very narrow staircase and you walk into the parents' room. Then there's a very narrow hallway, and to your right, or I'm sorry, your left, there is an attic space. And then you go forward into the children's room.
Yeah.
But it's, what is it? Maybe like 300 square feet
total?
Oh, it's
so small.
It's
being
so
there
tiny.
Puts everything into perspective. It's crazy, like being in every room where, we'll talk about this later, but all the rooms where it happened, taking the steps up the upstairs, the path that the killer must have taken. Yeah, pretty crazy. So
some point around midnight between Sunday, June 9th and Monday, June 10th of 1912, a person or persons came into the Moore house and bludgeoned everyone in the home to death. At 7 a.m. the next day, June 10th, Mary Peckham, who was the Moore's next-door neighbor, became concerned because she didn't see the Moore family out doing their chores. And kind of now we would think of that as like a nosy neighbor kind of thing.
Yeah.
But if you think back in the early 1900s, it took a whole family to run a household. I mean, they had to get their eggs from chickens and milk their cows and everything.
Yeah, and everybody looked out for each other. And that's what Mary Peckham was doing because a family of, you know, that many people, four kids, four, five, six, seven, eight. Yeah. So four kids, two adults. It was always bustling with activity. And when the, you know, morning, when the sun came up and they were not out there working on the farm,
it was unusual.
She knew something was going on. So she wanted to help them out and check it out. So,
so she did knock on the door and got no answer. She tried to open the door and it was locked. So she went ahead and called Ross Moore,
Josiah's brother.
Right.
But that was weird that the door was locked because nobody locked their doors in that town.
That's right.
Or back then in general. But I always say, lock your doors. You always have to lock your doors. But they didn't do that then. So it was weird that the door was locked.
Yes. So Ross came over and he had a key. So he opened the door. He walked in the kitchen and into the parlor and just peeked into the downstairs bedroom and saw two bumps covered in bloody sheets.
Yes.
So he backed right away, backed right out, and he called Josiah's implement store.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Seeley was the employee who answered the phone, and he said that, get Hank Horton over here, which was Villisca's main peace officer. Did they have actual police? They had, like, peace officers.
They didn't have police at the time there.
No.
So
Hank Horton was the peace officer for the town. So Horton's search of the house revealed that the entire Moore family and the two Stillinger girls were dead.
Yeah, and Ross was speechless after he saw what he saw. He just kind of, like, stumbled out to the back porch. He told Mary Peckham, something awful has happened, and that's really all he could say. He sat on the stairs, staring off into space, and that's his role in that.
There's somebody murdered in every bed, Hank told Ross when he came out of the house, and the murder weapon was actually an axe that belonged to Josiah Moore. Mm-hmm. So,
and it was still, are you going to talk about this? Or it was still in the bedroom.
It was still in the bedroom where the Stillinger girl slept.
Yes.
Yes, and I was going to get to
that. Oh, you were going to get to, okay, sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so once the murders were discovered, news traveled in this small town really quickly and beyond. Even, what, up to like 100 miles away?
Oh, yeah.
People were
obsessed. They were true crime obsessed, actually. Yeah.
Came immediately to this crime scene, and they say over 100 people traipsed through the house gawking at the dead bodies and even taking pieces of skull as like a memorabilia type thing.
So people think we're crazy and weird for being obsessed with true crime. They were a little more obsessed and a little weirder back then. I think that was really the beginning of murderabilia. You know, people would take things from crime scenes. They were obsessed with all this morbid stuff, and they would take whatever they could get. So
So the National Guard actually arrived around noon, and they finally got control of this scene. But obviously, it was completely contaminated at this point. Almost everything in it was almost worthless.
Yeah.
So here's what we know about the crime and the crime scene. All the doors in the home were locked, which, as Kelly mentioned, was out of the ordinary. They didn't lock their doors back then.
And locked from the inside, which you have to use like they had like a skeleton key type thing. It's not like they just pushed a button and locked it. The killer had to have locked it from the inside and left out, probably out of a window, so that the doors would stay locked. Because you can't lock them from the outside, or he couldn't have.
I don't know.
Yeah, so
that's
was
one of the mysteries.
Yeah.
So the killer must have worked really quickly and quietly, because it appears as if he killed both the adults first without waking any of the children.
Right, yeah.
Except possibly Lena Stillinger. She was the only one. According to the inquest testimony of Dr. F.S. Williams, Lena lay as though she had kicked one foot out of her bed sideways, with one hand up under the pillow on her right side, half sideways, not clear over, but just a little. Mm-hmm. Apparently, she had been struck in the head and squirmed down the bed, perhaps one third of the way. Her nightgown was slit up, and she was wearing no undergarments. Her underwear were later found underneath the bed.
Yeah. So
there was also a blood stain on the inside of her right knee, and the doctors assumed a wound on her arm that the doctors assumed was a defensive wound.
Yeah. Yeah. So, are we going to talk about the sexual assault?
I don't want to.
Okay. So I'll talk about that. So the fact that Lena was positioned in a weird way, she was nude from the waist down. Her underwear had been removed. You know, there's, you know, people kind of think maybe there was a sexual assault component, but it's totally up in the air. There's nothing definitive on that. They don't know for sure, but I think it's safe to say there probably was something going on. And the killer had put the oil lamp right next to Lena's body, you know, like to get a better look. So that's what they assume. Yeah. So, where are we now? Okay. So, the cigarette butts in the attic? Yeah?
No.
No? Okay.
It's also believed that Ina and Lena Stillinger were killed last. The reason for this theory is obviously because the axe was left in the bedroom where their bodies were.
Yeah.
And it looked like there was an attempt to wipe the axe clean, but there was still plenty of blood on it. Lena and Ina were actually the daughters of Joseph and Sarah Stillinger. They had seven sisters, and their mother was pregnant at the time. And unfortunately, her mother would not only lose Lena and Ina, but the baby that she was carrying because of the stress that she was under.
Yeah.
Sarah and Josiah were actually bludgeoned so badly that their face was unrecognizable. It's theorized that the killer used the sharp end of the axe on Josiah and the blunt end on everyone else. And after he had murdered everyone in the home, he went back to Sarah and Josiah and beat Josiah and possibly Sarah again.
Yes, yeah. He was brutal. There was basically nothing left of their faces or their heads. They were beaten to a pulp. That's what was left. Super graphic, horrible, brutal. Yeah.
So all the victims had been covered up with sheets and clothing after they were killed. There were also sheets and clothing covering all of the mirrors in the home. And every window had the curtains closed except for two windows that didn't have curtains. And those were covered with blankets and clothing.
Yeah.
So that was a little odd,
that
right?
That was weird. And he also covered up the phone with blankets and clothing. So do you talk about this at all? One theory about that is, so those old style phones, they had like the bells on the top. And what people think is, like, they got into the psychology of it. They thought it looked like a face to this killer, and that perhaps he didn't want to be seen. Like, that's why he covered the mirrors. He didn't want to see himself. He didn't want the eyes of that phone looking at him. Like, just very bizarre. But everything was covered in sheets and blankets and just very weird. It adds to the creepy factor. Not that it wasn't already creepy.
The ceilings in the bedrooms actually had, and still do have to this day, gouge marks in the ceiling from the upswing of the axe. And we can attest to the
gouge marks are still there. They're still there. And what's also there, you can't really see it, but a lot of people have gone and stayed at the house. They've done luminol tests on the walls and the ceiling. They've used luminol. And you can, the blood from 1912 is still detected. So, and it's everywhere. So back then, you know, you didn't have Service Master come in and clean up a crime scene. You had to do it yourself. And there are remnants left behind.
Yes. And this next fact, I think, is one of the most bizarre. There was a 4-pound slab of bacon wrapped in a dish towel found in the downstairs bedroom next to the axe.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, there are some theories. You want to talk about those?
I can do that. Yeah, you go.
Okay, this is gross, but some other podcasters and authors have gotten into this. Why would there be bacon taken out of the icebox and placed on the floor? Don't hate me for this. But some people have come up with the idea that it was used for, like, a lubrication, the bacon
That's
grease.
That's exactly what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah, sorry. But and there are other, so we're going to talk later about other cases that are linked to this one, probably the same killer. And he had done that at other scenes as well. So it was kind of like a calling card.
Well, on the kitchen table, there was a plate of uneaten food and a big bowl of water that looked like he had washed his hands in it.
Yeah.
And
that was also one of the things that he did at other crimes, too. Yeah.
So there were two spent cigarette butts in the attic. That led investigators to believe that he may have been laying in wait up there even before they got home from the church. He may have been in the house waiting for them to come home and go to sleep before he attacked.
Yeah. Yeah. So the attic was located right between the upstairs bedrooms of the children and the Moore parents. And like Lauren said, they found cigarette butts. It was as if someone had gone into the house while they were at church, been waiting for them, and sprung into action as soon as they fell asleep. And, yeah, that's what they think happened.
So, and then one theory they have, because Josiah was the only one killed with the blade of the axe, and he was bludgeoned worse than any other member of the family or anyone else in the house, it makes you question, was Josiah the main target?
Right.
And everyone else just collateral damage?
Yeah. Well, as we'll find out later, though, this killer did usually choose one victim in all of his killings to use the sharp end of the axe, the sharp edge of the axe on, which is strange. He always chose one person in each family to basically just, like, dissect their face with an axe, for lack of a better term, but yeah.
So several suspects emerged. First up, we have Frank Fernando Jones. He was a Villisca resident. He was also an Iowa state senator. Now, Josiah Moore had worked for Frank Jones in his implement store for many years before leaving and opening his own store. And it's said that Jones was extremely angry at Josiah Moore because when he opened his own store, he took a big account, John Deere dealership.
It was like their biggest client. So another reason, though, that Frank Jones hated Josiah Moore was because, now, this is not confirmed, but it's been said that Josiah Moore was having a torrid affair with Frank Jones's daughter-in-law, who was married to his son. But Sarah's ghost told me differently in an exclusive interview right at the Villisca Axe Murder House.
I was there.
Yeah.
So another theory was that Senator Jones had hired a man named William Blackie Mansfield to murder the Moore family. So William Mansfield of Blue Island, Illinois, was the prime suspect of the Burns Detective Agency out of Kansas City and Detective James Newton Wilkerson. Mansfield was also known as George Worley and or Jack Turnbaugh. And according to Wilkerson, the private investigator, Mansfield was a cocaine fiend and serial killer.
I like the name, the Burns Detective Agency. It sounds like an old movie. Hello, thank you for calling the Burns Detective Agency. So, yeah.
So, Wilkerson believed that Mansfield was responsible for the axe murder of his wife, infant child, father-in-law, and mother-in-law in Blue Island, Illinois on July 5th, 1914, which was 2 years after the Villisca murder. But he's also believed to be responsible for an axe murder committed in Paola, Kansas, 4 days before the Villisca murders and the murders of Jenny Peterson and Jenny Miller in Aurora, Colorado. According to Wilkerson's investigation, all of the murders were committed in precisely the same manner, indicating that the same person committed them. Wilkerson stated that he could prove that Mansfield was present in each of the places on the night of the murders. In each murder, the victims were hacked to death with an axe and the mirrors in the homes were covered. A burning lamp with the chimney off was left at the foot of the bed, and a basin in which the murderer washed was found in the kitchen. So this is sounding a lot like Villisca, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in each case, the murderer avoided leaving fingerprints by wearing gloves, and they think that Mansfield would have definitely done that because his fingerprints were actually on file in Montgomery County, at the military prison in Leavenworth.
Yeah. Yeah. So he would have worn gloves to avoid that.
So Wilkerson managed to convince a grand jury to open an investigation in 1916, and Mansfield was arrested and brought to Montgomery County from Kansas City. However, payroll records provided an alibi that placed Mansfield in Illinois at the time of the Villisca murders. So,
yeah,
it wasn't him. And then, actually, Mansfield went on to sue the private investigator and won $2,225.
Yeah.
In 1912, I don't know, that'd be like couple million today.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, so that was one suspect, but
yes,
that was debunked. So,
and this brings us to our next suspect, Reverend George Kelly. Kelly, what do you think of Reverend George Kelly?
He was a freak. He was a weirdo. He was a pervert. Everyone in town knew it. Now, this was super racy for the time, but he put an ad in the newspaper, classified ads, because he needed a secretary. And he got some feedback, some people who were like, yes, I'll be your secretary. But when that happened, he said, there's one stipulation. You need to type in the nude. For those times, that was really racy, scandalous. So he was actually arrested for this, just for that. He was also a known window peeper, you know, so he made a good suspect, but wasn't him, in my opinion.
I don't know. So Reverend Kelly was a traveling minister, and
he wasn't even really a reverend. He made people call him reverend, but technically he wasn't. I read that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, but he actually attended the Children's Day service that night, the night of the murder. And the following morning at 5:19, he boarded a train in Villisca, the number 5 train, and allegedly told other passengers that there were 8 dead souls back in Villisca having being axed to death. And this was at 5 a.m., 5:19 a.m., and the bodies weren't discovered until after 8 a.m.
Yeah, so how did he know that?
In the weeks that followed, he displayed a fascination with the case and wrote many letters to police, investigators, and family of the deceased. He actually returned to Villisca 2 weeks later and posed as a detective to join a tour of the house.
Yeah.
Like,
a little sus.
Yeah.
He was pretty sus. He wanted to implant himself in this investigation. He was fascinated, again, with the morbid fascination. He just wanted to be right there knowing everything that happened.
So because of these crazy letters he was writing, the police became suspicious, and they got the idea to respond to one of his letters and ask him what he knew about the murders. So he replied in great detail, claiming to have heard sounds and possibly even witnessed the murders.
Yeah. Yeah. So what they think might have happened, or one theory is that, like, he was a known window peeper, he was a known pervert, that maybe he was window peeping into their house and observed the murder happen, but was too afraid to say anything at first because he would have been to blame. But eventually, after looking at him, they, you know, like, exonerated him.
They did actually arrest him.
They did, yeah.
And he did go to trial.
Yep.
But in 1917,
yeah.
But he was acquitted.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so there are other theories that this Villisca axe murder could have been attributed to maybe one of the first known serial killers in America. We haven't talked about the book, The Man from the Train, yet,
no.
But by Bill James, but you should read it. It's great. It's the most thorough investigation of the Villisca axe murders and a lot of other ones that happened in the U.S. around that time.
Well,
yeah.
Bill James and his daughter, Rachel McCarthy,
yeah,
James, in the book, they concluded that the murderer was a man named Paul Mueller, who was an immigrant, possibly from Germany, who was the subject of an unsuccessful year-long manhunt as the sole suspect in the 1897 murder of a family in West Brooksfield, Massachusetts, who had employed him as a farmhand. The Jameses thus believed that Mueller was guilty of the Villisca murders as part of a killing spree that lasted over a decade, killing at least 59 people in 49 different,
yeah,
incidents.
So why were there so many axe murders in the early 1900s? Well, it's because everybody had an axe. That's why. It was,
yeah,
like a very easy weapon to just grab and kill somebody. So,
right.
Yeah. That's why.
So, aside from Reverend Kelly, he was the only one ever taken to court and tried, but he was acquitted. No one else has ever been arrested for this crime, and it remains one of the most horrific unsolved mass murders in American history.
Yeah. Yep. Still unsolved.
And we slept in that house.
We did. So, should we go to the paranormal side?
Yeah. Let's tell them a little bit.
To the dark side.
Couple minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So if you're like me, when fall rolls around, I'm all about the pumpkin spice lattes, the pumpkin patches, orchards, all the cool, cute, scary stuff.
Very
haunted
basic.
Houses.
She's all very basic.
I'm a basic bitch. So, yes. So I had always, being from Iowa, I just was fascinated by this case, and I had always dreamed of going and spending the night there. I finally gathered a group of 8 brave souls to go with me. Lauren was one of them. I drug her to Iowa in, like, the worst weather we had had that entire fall. Cold, rain, everything. When I first asked her to come, she was like, well, what's the temperature going to be at the time? And I said, dear, it could be anything from 70 degrees to snow on the ground. It's not Florida. So anyway, we headed to Des Moines, Iowa. We had a really fun meetup that weekend with Generation Y, Justin from Generation Y, but he was too scared to go with us, I think.
He didn't come with us to the house.
But we did get a group of paranormal investigators together because we thought that would be fun. And a psychic medium came, and just some really cool, unique people. And they brought all of this equipment with them. EMF detectors, like the dowsing rods. Dowsing rods.
Yeah.
A lot of electronics that are supposed to find cold spots and things
right,
like that.
Yeah.
A pendulum. Oh, and I've always been scared of these, but I bought a Ouija board and brought it with me. So I was super extra for this trip.
I was not cool with the Ouija board.
No, but we used all of these things. And I also wanted to say, this is known as possibly the most haunted house in America, if you believe in stuff like that. But it's easy to see why it would be. I mean, 8 people were brutally murdered there.
Right, and it's actually been investigated by
Zach Bagel Bites. Does anyone listen to And That's Why We Drink?
Discovery Channel's been in there. The Travel Channel's been in there.
Yep.
It's been
Ghost
featured
Adventures
on a lot of haunted shows.
BuzzFeed Unsolved. So everybody who has a show like that, they've all been to Villisca, so we needed to come too. So like I said, we had 8 of us, which was kind of eerie because there were 8 people murdered in the house, and we realized that after. We were like, oh, that's scary. So we did all the things. We also had pizza. We had like 2 comedian people with us who were hilarious. We had lots of beer and things like that. It was actually very fun.
It was like a sleepover.
I thought it was fun. Lauren did not think it was so fun. So right when we got there, she felt this like overwhelming feeling of heaviness. And talk about that a little bit.
Okay. So it's hard to explain. When we first got there, I'm standing there completely fine. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, my chest got very heavy. And I started ugly crying. And
yeah.
I couldn't stop myself. I'm not kidding. I mean, it was the strangest thing that's ever happened to me. I don't know what it was. And it lasted 3-5 minutes tops, and then I was completely fine.
Yeah.
It was almost like, whoa. And I just was crying so hard, like, you know?
I'm going to chalk it up to, like, you were just thinking about the story before we came. Because we listened to every podcast we could find on the way to the trip, because it was a few hours of driving. And I think we were just talking about these kids being murdered, and it was so sad. Maybe you were just feeling that.
Maybe.
Or maybe you were possessed for, like, 5 minutes. I don't know. So, but I didn't really feel that way. I'm totally a skeptic. I love all the scary stuff. If I had proof that ghosts were real, my life would be over because I would never sleep with the lights off again. I would bury my head under the cover. So I just tell myself that stuff isn't real. I just have fun with it. But I really love it. I love everything paranormal. So anyway, it grew dark. There's no electricity in the house.
None.
We just had lantern lights, flashlights, things like that. We did live stream, too, from it. But
we did.
So we started the Ouija board, and Sarah.
I did not start. I didn't.
She
touch the
sat
Ouija
in the
board.
Corner.
I want that to be clear.
Yeah. But supposedly Sarah's ghost came through, and we started asking questions to get to the bottom of this affair thing that we heard about with Josiah, and Sarah adamantly denied through the Ouija board that her husband had an affair She said he would never do that. So I don't know. Ghosts can be tricky, but that's what she said. So anyway, the house costs about $500 a night. You can rent it. You go to Villisca. I think it's VillisCaIowa.org. I think something like that. It's
just
easy
Google
to find. Just
Villisca,
Google Villisca.
Ask
if you
want to
rent it,
house.
You can at any time. I just thought it was a cozy, cute farmhouse. I was comfortable there. I had a lot of fun. We are actually renting it again this October, so we're going to get together another group of paranormal investigators. It's going to be our Halloween special. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into the crimes and the theories and the suspects and try to, you know, dive a little deeper, especially after reading the book, The Man from the Train. I have some more questions I need to ask. So, yeah. We ended the night, well, most of us stayed up pretty much all night. Lauren slept in the Jeep. The rest of us, you know, stayed up all night being teenagers again, playing, like, having a sleepover. But we recorded our final thoughts the next morning.
Yes.
What everyone thought. The overwhelming consensus, and there were eight of us, like I said, everyone thought they kind of felt something. The next day, we went over all of our recordings and stuff, and we had people sending us things they found. I said I'm a skeptic, but I definitely could hear some of what they were pointing out. We heard, there were definite words. I don't know if it was a ghost or if it was we were overhearing somebody from another room, but it didn't sound like
on
that.
On my audio for... I caught several, what I feel like were like bona fide EVPs.
Yeah. And I heard, I mean, you could hear people, like a woman's voice whispering ominous things.
Yes.
We both put all of our content on our YouTube channels. So if you want to see the things that came through on the Ouija board, it's very creepy, actually. I've had people who said they had to turn it off because it was scaring them. But if you want to do that, you can go to my YouTube page, which is youtube.com/KellyBrinkTV. Lauren and Ken from Paradise After Dark have a YouTube page as well.
And it's just Paradise After Dark. You can find it easily.
Yeah. And then I also did a deep, kind of deep dive, like a two-part episode on the crime itself. So if you go back to my podcast, the audio version, and look for the Villisca Axe Murders, you can find that. And I also did a part two on our paranormal investigation part of that. So what do you think, Lauren? Who do you think did this? I have a theory. What do you
think? I think it was Reverend Kelly.
Do you?
I do.
I mean, I do like him as a suspect.
But then that doesn't explain the other murders that had the same very odd details.
And
like
we
the
didn't
bacon
even,
and the clothing covering mirrors. That
and
is
the bowl
super
of water.
Odd. That's super weird, you know what I mean? Like, to have
and the
that
lamp.
Same
we
thing at
we
different
didn't talk
time
about
scenes.
The glass oil lamp either. The
oh,
the
yeah,
chimney.
At the foot of the parents' bed, there was an oil lamp, and the chimney, the glass chimney, was off. And the wick was bent down to make the flame smaller.
Yes.
And the chimney was actually found under the dresser. And downstairs in where Lena and Ina were murdered, same exact thing.
Yeah.
There was a oil lamp, the chimney was off, and the wick was bent. And at some of the other crime scenes.
Right. I was going to say,
they found the exact same thing.
Yeah. So not many people would do
the oil
that.
Lamps.
Yeah.
Right.
So we didn't get to talk about all the other axe murders that happened in the early 1900s across the U.S., but there were a lot. Last week in my podcast, I covered the Hardy House murders, which happened in 1910. So they think the same serial killer did both of these, and that because same exact thing, like the axe, the bowl of water, everything.
All of the homes were near a railroad.
I was just going to say that, Lauren. They were. So that's why it's called The Man from the Train, the book, because they were every house that he went to was very close to the railroad because he wanted a quick getaway. So, And we have just breezed through this so quickly, but we only had 40 minutes. So
yes,
there's so much more to it.
We could probably do like a 2-hour episode with no ad breaks.
I think somebody could do like a full deep dive podcast just about
maybe
this.
If they included all the other murders.
Yeah, definitely. But does anyone have any questions? Yeah. Like the locations he traveled to, he would have, but he wasn't like in the same place at the same times when any of the other ones happened. And he traveled, but he did stay in Villisca kind of long term for a while. So, yeah. Anybody else? So, I did want to tell you guys. So this October, at the end of October, like I said, we are renting the Villisca Axe Murder House again. We already have 10 people. We can only have 10 people. But we're doing a show that weekend in Des Moines, Iowa. It's going to be a true crime variety show that I am writing myself. And it's going to be the first and only one of its kind. So if you want to go to my website, truecrimeirl.com, we're both going to be there. We're going to have musicians, comedians, other podcasters, horror writers. It's going to be epic, so stay tuned for that. Yeah. Anybody else? Or any general podcasting questions or anything like that? No? If not, thank you for coming, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.